Times have changed. Over the last 50 years or so, our culture has undergone such a dramatic shift that has been compared to the shift that took place from the medieval to the modern era. It's changed that much. We fully entered into what's been called the postmodern era. So what's postmodernism and why should we even care? Well, at its core, it's a shift away from a belief in universal objective truth and toward a reliance on personal subjective truth. This is why it's not uncommon to hear people today say things like, well, that may be true for you, but it's not true for me. Or I'm looking for a truth that works for me. Or I don't like it when people argue that their group or their beliefs are better than others. Or I'm suspicious of narratives that try to explain everything. Or I don't like the institution of religion. A few years ago, a Canadian author by the name of Brian Fraser wrote a book about sharing the gospel in the postmodern culture. And he said this, notions of absolute, natural, or divine morality in our pre-evangelism is a non-starter with people who do not accept anything as absolute. It's so true. So what do we do as Christ followers since we believe in moral absolutes? We believe in truth. In fact, we follow the one who declared himself to be the truth. If I'm having a conversation with a non-Christian who doesn't even accept the notion of universal truth or moral absolutes, and I make that my opening declaration, then the conversation is over before it even begins. That's what Brian Fraser's saying, because that's where I am versus where they are. Now, personally, I don't see postmodernism as a catastrophe, but as an opportunity. Being surrounded by a culture that shares little to none of our own worldview puts us in an environment very similar to the New Testament. I mean, I get it. It makes it tougher on us. We're less at home, less popular, and forced to adjust the way we communicate our message in order to be understood. The world no longer operates largely from a Christian consensus or worldview. You and I are going to have to learn new ways of sharing our faith because the old ways, the tried and true methods of the past, are not nearly as effective. Eventually, we might even face persecution in our own country for our beliefs. But Christianity has always fared better as a persecuted minority than a preferred majority. Persecution will always make the real Christians stand out. Besides, we're meant to be lights shining in the darkness. Our role is not to curse the darkness, but to be the candle. Bottom line, if we live in a society that worships the creation more than the creator, then we live in the same world as Paul, because that's what he wrote about in Romans 1. If the world is asking, what is truth? Then we live in the same world as Jesus, because that's what he was asked in John 18. If the world considers everything it reads to be a matter of personal interpretation, then we live in the exact same world as Peter, because that's what he faced in 2 Peter 1. In other words, we're living in a society that's just like the one that God chose to invade 2,000 years ago. But in that environment, the good news about Jesus spread like wildfire. Do you know why? Because life without God at the center, a life that's just centered on the self, is a hollow way to live. It doesn't even compare to the new life we have in Christ, but people have to see that lived out. They're attracted by a compelling alternative. They're not attracted by our arguments. So let's begin with this, learning from the early church. When Paul was on his missionary journey, he got sidetracked in Athens while he was waiting for Silas and Timothy to catch up with him. Here's what the Bible says happened. The longer Paul waited in Athens for Silas and Timothy, the angrier he got. All those idols. The city was a junkyard of idols. So get this. Paul sees idolatry on a scale he's never seen before, and it really bothers him. It made him angry. He was offended for God. And maybe you can relate, because a lot of people are feeling that way today. We're offended for God. It seems today we face more intentional provocation, more in-your-face offense than at any other time in our history. But even though Paul got angry, and his anger was understandable, what Paul did with his anger is even more important. Did he organize a Christian boycott of the Athens marketplace? No. Did he walk around with the city with a sign that said, God hates idols? Again, no. Did he stand up in the city square and preach a turn or burn sermon? No, he does none of those things. Instead, without any reservation or hesitation, he engages the Athenians in deep discussions about the meaning of life. You need to understand, Athens was the intellectual capital of the world with great philosophers like Plato and Aristotle. Paul engaged in debate with people of understanding and education. I'll tell you something else he did. He embraced what was good in their philosophy because you can find truth everywhere. This is where black and white thinkers will always struggle. Seldom is anyone 100% wrong. If you can't acknowledge when an enemy is right or makes a valid point, then you'll never influence them to do anything other than oppose you. It's clear when you read about Paul's approach in Acts 17 that he studied their philosophy carefully. He even quotes a rather obscure poet, which tells you that the Apostle Paul was really well read outside the spiritual source resources that he was already familiar with. He stayed true to his own beliefs, but he engaged them in their unbelief without judging or condemning them. So here's how Paul approached them. The Bible says, so Paul took his stand in the open space at the Areopagus and laid it out for them. It is plain to see that you Athenians take your religion seriously. When I arrived here the other day, I was fascinated with all the shrines I came across. And then I found one inscribed to the God nobody knows. I'm here to introduce you to this God so you can worship intelligently, knowing who you're dealing with. Basically, what he says is, I can see that you have a deep spiritual hunger. He tells them that God is not far from them. And like I said, he even quotes their books, their authorities. By the way, we only have two full-length sermons from the Apostle Paul in the book of Acts, one before a Jewish audience and the other, this one, before Mars Hill, where he's speaking to non-Christians. The Jewish sermon is filled with Bible quotations because he's speaking to Jews who recognize the Bible's authority. But this sermon on Mars Hill doesn't have a single Bible quotation in it at all. Why? Because the philosophers on Mars Hill had no knowledge of the scripture. They could care less what Paul's holy book said. So Paul uses their authorities and their reasoning to talk to them about the spiritual life. There's also a briefer message that Paul preaches later in the book of Acts to Gentiles at Lystra. This is in Acts 13, and it also has no quotations from scripture. Now here's the truth. Our hearts were made to seek God. And Paul found evidence of that even in their idolatry. You see, God had already been at work in Athens long before Paul showed up on the scene. God was preparing their hearts by showing them that maybe there was something more than what they were settling for. And what Paul experienced in Athens that day is still going on today. People are restless. They seek what doesn't satisfy. And God has left witnesses to himself everywhere, in books, magazines, movies, and music. Are you discerning enough to see the fingerprints of God all around us? Could you, from popular music or movies or book, help point people to God? Because that's basically what Paul's doing here. He's reading and interpreting their culture to find points of connection. What I'm saying is we need to start meeting people where they are instead of demanding they be where we are. We need to listen what our culture is saying and to understand the shape of their hunger so that we can bring them to Christ. The provocation of culture is out of sync with God, and that ought to lead us to do something out of love. Now, let me be really honest with you. I came to Christ in an ultra-fundamentalist church. We did it all wrong. I was harsh, dogmatic, and narrow-minded. I used to preach on the streets of downtown Nashville with a bullhorn. I did turn or burn messages at the Nashville Rescue Mission. I did Rambo-style evangelism, going door to door and asking people, if you were to die tonight, do you know where you'd spend eternity? Now, I know those of you who know me now can't imagine that I was ever that way, but I was. Back then, among the fundamentalists, they would say I was bold. Me, looking back on those experiences now, I would say I was a jerk. By the way, there's always someone at Spring Creek telling me our church ought to do more of that sort of evangelism. In fact, it was only a few weeks ago, someone told me through an email that the only way to win the lost was to condemn them. And I reminded them what Jesus said, that he didn't come into the world to condemn the world, but that the world through him might be saved. I'm going to do it the Jesus way, because I've done it the other way, and it doesn't work. I'll tell you something else about those caustic methods of evangelism. I can't point to a single person who came to Christ through those methods, but there are likely countless numbers of people I turned off to churches, to preachers, and to Christ because I was a jerk. People are never attacked into the kingdom. They're either attracted by what they see and experience, or else they never come at all. Something else I want to remind you of, and it's again, it's ground we've covered before. It's staying centered in our thinking. Now, Jesus gave us two great commandments, to love God with all of our heart, soul, mind, and strength, and to love our neighbors as ourselves. He told us this is how that people would know that we belong to him, that we would be a community of people who irrationally love God and other people. But something has shifted over the years. Christians have begun to define themselves primarily by their beliefs instead of their love. And this is what has led to so much exclusivity and judgmentalism, a spirit of us versus them, and why we have so much difficulty embracing the outsider. Without a doubt, one of the most striking aspects of Jesus' approach to people was the way he treated those who were thought to be outside the people of God. If no one's ever explained this to you, what made Jesus' approach different, let me explain it to you now. There's no question, Jesus spent his time with the losers in society. We never see him condemning or accusing these people. Instead, he just loves and accepts them. The people Jesus accuses and condemns are the self-righteous, the self-justifying, the holier-than-thou, and the ultra-religious folks. It's not that Jesus didn't love those people too. It's just that they were getting in the way of people who were moving toward God, which is one of the most egregious sins we can commit in Jesus' book. If our words or actions hinder someone who is moving toward God, that's something that will always provoke the anger of Christ. So how was Jesus' approach different? Well, the best way to describe it is the difference between bounded sets and centered sets. So first, let me talk to you about bounded sets. For example, an apple is always an apple. Apples may be Macintosh, Jonathan, Winesap, or Red Delicious. They might be green, yellow, or red, but everyone knows an apple's an apple, and an apple's never a potato. That's a bounded set. It's a way of describing or categorizing things or people. But this is one of our great temptations, to look at people in terms of bounded sets. In other words, we tend to see people as either in or out of a particular set. This is especially true when it comes to what we think makes a Christian a Christian. So in bounded set thinking, we start defining a Christian by what they are externally and in the most superficial ways. We'll say a Christian is someone who's been baptized, or a Christian is someone who attends church, or a Christian is someone who reads their Bible and prays, or a Christian doesn't smoke, or a Christian doesn't watch R-rated movies, or a Christian can't be a Democrat. I mean, you probably heard someone say something like that at some point in your life. Someone set a standard for what they believe a Christian is, and anyone who doesn't meet that standard is out in their book. That's bounded set thinking. It's what leads to judgmentalism. But Jesus was not a bounded set thinker. Instead, he thought in terms of centered sets. In centered set thinking, the issue is not being in or out of a certain category. Instead, in a centered set, we define things by movement. In other words, are people moving toward or away from the center? So we're no longer defining people by what exists at the boundaries or the most superficial markers of their life. Instead, we're thinking in terms of whether they're moving toward or away from God. This is how Jesus thought, and this is what was of supreme importance to him, whether we're moving toward or away from God. This is also what Paul was doing in Athens. He looked for evidence of movement. He looked for signs that the God question mattered to these people. He looked and he found it even in their idolatry. He acknowledged that they hungered for God, even though they didn't understand who that God was. It's only when you understand bounded set thinking versus centered set thinking that the New Testament starts to make sense. I mean, the Pharisees, although they were thought to be near to God, were actually moving away from God in their attitude and behavior. On the other hand, tax collectors and prostitutes, who were considered to be far from God, were at least moving in the right direction. They were moving toward God. The Pharisees were all about the boundary markers, the temple, the Torah, and keeping the Sabbath. You were in if you did those things. That's bounded set thinking. Sadly, today, Christians often think more like Pharisees than they do like Jesus. We use the most superficial and external indicators to determine who's in and who's out, who are God's people and who are not. Which leads me to this. With Jesus, it's all about the direction you're heading. You see, if Christianity's a bounded set, our goal will be to get people to cross the boundary from the outside to the inside. In our thinking, once they're in, no further progress is necessary, which is why the church today is filled with so many immature, undiscipled people. Christians think that once someone is in, they can turn their attention to get others to cross the boundary line of faith. In part, this thinking is what has led to the idea that church is supposed to be an evangelistic crusade every week, where the pastor leads everybody to Jesus and the congregation just sits back passively and watches it happen from week to week. Once people have trusted Jesus, that's the end all be all. We're done. Now we just sit around and wait for the rapture bus to take us home. That's where boundary-oriented thinking leads us. But once we learn to think like Jesus, then I understand my daily responsibility is to constantly reorient toward the center. And when it comes to those outside the faith, our job is to encourage movement toward God. Now listen, there might be many things in a person's life and belief that need changing. I get that. But that's not my primary concern. I don't condemn the world for acting like the world. How can they be anything other than what they are without the power, grace, and forgiveness of God to change their life? Only God has the power to free us to become the people we were meant to be. My primary concern is to stay out of God's way and not impede the movement toward Him, but instead encourage it. My job is to keep people moving toward God. So in our time remaining, what I'd like to do is talk to you about sharing our life and love with outsiders. And the first thing I would tell you is live your gospel. You know, the traditional mode of evangelism that's worked well in the past was to give people a clear, rational presentation of truth. Once they were convinced of the truth, they made a decision to believe it and act upon it. But today, the questions have changed. Andy Crouch said it best. He said, "The question young people around me are asking is not, is Christianity true? But is Christianity worth believing?" It's a subtle difference. The first question can be answered by marshaling the evidence, which is a job for lawyers. The second requires the demonstration of an attractive vision, which is a job for artists. It's a good point. In postmodern thinking, truth itself is the issue. I believe in truth, and I believe that Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life. But just because I can articulate that and even build a better argument for truth than the average layperson, it still doesn't get near the traction that argument used to get. For example, in his book, Engaging Unbelief, Curtis Chang tells a story of winning a hard-fought intellectual argument with a young skeptic named Alex. Knowing that he had decisively refuted Alex's arguments against the Christian faith, Curtis paused. He waited for the moment when Alex would say, "Okay, so what do I need to do to become a Christian?" Instead, Alex said, "Yeah, well, so what?" You see, G.K. Chesterton's prophecy has come true. He said, "After God, the problem is not that people will believe in nothing, it's that they will believe in anything." In such a world, carefully reasoned arguments are as effective as using a knife to cut the ocean. The main point of apologetics is to show the reasonableness of the Christian faith. This means producing arguments that demonstrate why Christianity is objectively true. The problem is postmoderns don't put much trust in those arguments. Instead, they want to know, what difference does it make? How has it changed you and the world around you? Because if all you've got is an argument, but not a life to back it up, you got nothing. The face of apologetics is changing. Much like the first century, the most compelling apologetic the church possesses and still possesses is how our faith helps to create a better world. Listen to Dr. Timothy Keller. Early Christian bishops in the Roman Empire, by contrast, were so well known for identifying with the poor and weak that eventually, though part of a minority religion, they were seen to have the right to speak for the local community as a whole. Caring for the poor and the weak became, ironically, a major reason for the cultural influence the church eventually came to wield. If a church does not identify with the marginalized, it will itself be marginalized. This is God's poetic justice. If a church is not moving deeper into the brokenness of our world, it will lose its power and effectiveness, and all the most compelling arguments in the world won't change that. This is why Spring Creek has always been about caring for the poor, supporting orphans in Africa and South America, and supporting those organizations in our community on the front lines of helping our most vulnerable citizens. Even now, we're working to create a new home for the most effective nonprofits in our city. When people in the community learn about what we're doing to organize this effort, the most common response we hear is that's what churches are supposed to be doing. That's what you guys are supposed to be all about. Now, to me, it's amazing that the world oftentimes knows better than the church that the Father's business is to take care of the poor. The Bible reminds us of this truth: let your light shine before others that they might see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven. When Jesus says good works, the word for good is kalos. Kalos means attractive or beautiful or lovely. What Jesus is saying is that people will be attracted by the beauty of our life, by the beauty of the things that we're doing. In other words, it's the good stuff that leads others to the God stuff. When was the last time you did something beautiful for God? E. Stanley Jones said it like this: go out each day and do something nobody but a Christian would do. We need to be doing beautiful things for God. That's how we lead others out of the darkness and into the light. We don't argue people out of darkness. We lead them with the light. And what I'm saying is, if Jesus is your truth, the greatest validation of that will not be a compelling argument. It will be his character shining forth through your life in the love for the least of these. Now, regardless of what you might think of Rob Bell, he's dead right when he says, it is when the church gives itself away in radical acts of service and compassion, expecting nothing in return, that the way of Christ is most vividly put on display. The world is looking for evidence of the life of Christ. Somehow, they intrinsically know what real Christians are supposed to be like. They're just waiting and watching to see if we're going to do it. Because all they seem to see instead are churches that are more interested in building massive real estate empires and lavish lifestyles for pastors and callousness toward the brokenness of our world. They want nothing to do with that. Postmoderns want to see the gospel lived out and won't respect when it's preached unless they see it backed up by a lifestyle that matches Jesus. Here's a second thing we keep in mind. To be an influence in the world, we have to be a sympathetic listener. If you want to win people to Christ, it can't and won't be done in a comfortable way. You're going to be around people who are going to make you feel uncomfortable. You're going to hear ideas that are completely at odds with what you believe. Let me give you some advice from Benjamin Franklin. Benjamin Franklin, whose personal faith fell somewhere on the spectrum between deism and biblical Christianity, wrote his own biography, and in it, he had a brilliant practice for handling dicey discussions. He talked about how he made a habit of not disagreeing with people right off the bat. Listen to this. When another asserted something that I thought an error, I denied myself the pleasure of contradicting him abruptly and of showing him immediately some absurdity in his position. Instead, I began by observing that in certain case or circumstances, his opinion would be right. Then he talked about how that simple change, that pivot in his approach, led to a dramatic difference. Listen to this. I soon found the advantage of this change in my manner. The conversations I engaged in went on more pleasantly. The modest way in which I proposed my opinions procured them a readier reception and less contradiction. And I more easily prevailed with others to give up their mistakes and join with me when I happened to be in the right. Now, when someone attacks your belief, it's easy to let your emotions flare and then just come out swinging. It's easy to get angry. I mean, even Paul got angry on Mars Hill when he saw the rampant idolatry, but he didn't let his anger keep him from affirming what he could see that was positive. The best way to describe this practice is truthful agreement. You practice truthful agreement, which means I acknowledge and agree with what I'm able to, even if I'm just agreeing with the fact that I can see how you would see it that way. I become a sympathetic listener. Now, some of you might recognize the name E. Stanley Jones. He was an American Methodist missionary in India. He became friends with Gandhi, even wrote a biography of him that Dr. Martin Luther King read that inspired him to nonviolence. One time, Jones asked Gandhi what missionaries could do to make Christianity more acceptable in India. This is what he asked. What would you, as one of the Hindu leaders of India, tell me, a Christian, to do in order to make this possible? Gandhi was very direct. Listen to this. First, I would suggest that all of you Christians, missionaries and all, must begin to live more like Jesus Christ. Second, practice your religion without adulterating it or toning it down. Third, emphasize love and make it your driving force. for love is central in Christianity. And fourth, study the non-Christian religions more sympathetically to find the good that is within them in order to have a more sympathetic approach to the people. Now, Gandhi's response sounds a lot like what the Apostle Paul modeled. Make love your driving force. And notice how Gandhi even said, don't water down your beliefs. Be Christians. Be fully Christian. I mean, Gandhi got it. He understood the New Testament better than most Christians do. But he also told Jones to study non-Christian religions, to find the good in them, and build on that common ground. This is how we will win the present generation. People will never be influenced by you if they think they're unheard by you. Rolling over someone with a Bible bulldozer does nothing but strengthen their resistance. We need to be bridge building, not bridge burning. Another thing we need to do, we need to recover biblical hospitality. Listen to this. This is Dr. Timothy Keller. In an increasingly privatized, secularized society, people will not listen to the gospel from strangers, not to people who come to their door, not to strangers who call on them, mail them, or even advertise to them. Now, most methods of evangelism today are impersonal. They don't rely on relationship, but on preaching, booklets, and strangers who approach other strangers. When evangelism is impersonal and not done in the context of a personal relationship, then people who are won over are not assimilated well into the church because they don't really know anyone personally. It's hard to make connections when you know no one at all. But that doesn't happen when you come to Christ in a relationship through a newly formed friendship by someone you've come to know and to trust. People easily become a part of the church because they're already deeply connected to someone in the church. But that type of personal evangelism, for all intents and purposes, barely exists today. An estimated 80% of Christians don't have close relationships with non-Christians. This is why I say love is the essential work of evangelism, because people can tell when they're a project and they don't like it any more than you do. I mean, have you ever had a long-lost friend reach out to you and ask you out for lunch or coffee, and you're just so excited to reconnect, but after you're together for about 10 minutes into lunch, they ask you, have you ever heard of Amway or some other pyramid marketing scheme? And you go from elated to deflated in 1 second flat. That's because no one wants to be befriended with an ulterior motive, even if it's a good motive like introducing someone to Christ. No one wants to feel targeted by your intentions, whatever they are. So are you forming intentional relationships with people who are not Christians? And I'm not talking about forming a friendship for the purpose of leading them to Christ, because that's the project mentality. A good test of our attitude on this is this: will you remain their friend even if they don't respond to your witness? You know, I believe evangelism has to begin with hospitality. Hospitality is tied to loving and welcoming those who are outside your normal circle of friends. It's about opening your life to people who don't think like you, look like you, or act like you. That's biblical hospitality. Hospitality requires us to first overcome our initial human reaction of suspicion or hostility toward people who are different from us. The Latin root of our English word hostility is hostis, and it means enemy. But our Christian task is to turn the stranger who's perceived as an enemy, a hostis, into a hospes, which is the Latin word for guest. This is where we get our word hospitality from. So are you intentionally putting yourself in an environment that's strange to you among people who are different from you? Because if you do that often, your natural hostility towards strangers will gradually melt away. You begin to realize that people are people, even if they look or act differently than you. You know, nothing has broken down the walls of hostility towards strangers for me more than traveling in places like all over Africa and in South America. The experience of being in the position of being the outsider, of trying to navigate society without knowing their language or culture, or being a minority, even if it's only for a couple of weeks, helps me to get out of my shoes and into someone else's shoes to see life from a different perspective. Hospitality requires the willingness to create an open space in our hearts where outsiders can enter. Henry Nouwen explained it beautifully. We must open up within ourselves a space, an open and safe space that welcomes the stranger and allows that person to enter, and perhaps most importantly, allows them to be themselves. Only then can transformation take place. Hospitality then has everything to do with treating and welcoming people the way that Jesus did. You know, the Bible has a lot to say about aliens, foreigners, sojourners, and strangers. And the Bible makes very clear how we treat them matters a great deal to God. The best summation of the Bible's teaching on this is found in Exodus 22:21. When a foreigner resides among you in your land, do not mistreat them. The foreigner residing among you, you must treat as your native born. Love them as yourself, for you were foreigners in Egypt. I am the Lord your God. You remember when Jesus said we're to love our neighbor as ourselves? This is the verse he was quoting. We need to pay attention to the fact that the neighbor in this verse, that the verse is referring to, is the immigrant, the stranger among us. So anti-immigrant attitudes have no place in the heart of a child of God, period, full stop. Israel knew firsthand the experience of being the immigrant, and God never wanted his people to forget that. They knew what it was like to be taken advantage of and exploited for personal gain. So God says, what was done to you, you must never do to another. Today, we're surrounded by immigrants, so much so that when you walk down the average street in the U.S., you will encounter in 10 minutes more anthropological diversity than an 18th century traveler did in their entire lifetime. So as a nation, we're a kaleidoscope of nationalities, colors, beliefs, especially in our city, the city of Garland. Did you know that Garland is in the top 10 most integrated cities in America with populations in excess of 100,000 people? Many cities have diverse populations, but they're ghettoized. In other words, people are grouped in various sectors of the city, but they're not integrated. Garland is integrated. All of our neighborhoods are mixed. When I walk in the morning, I greet my neighbors, and they're this beautiful blend of the nations of the world. In Romans 12, Paul makes a list of the marks of a true Christian. It's a great passage. You need to take some time to read it. But in verse 13, he tells us believers extend hospitality to strangers. You know, back in college, I started an international student ministry because I realized that many countries that were closed to the gospel, those countries that would not allow foreign missionaries to enter their country, they were still sending their people here to get an education. Often the ones that we were sending to us were the best and brightest from their respective countries. And I started thinking, what if we reached them while they were here? What if at the very least they met a real Christian who loved them, accepted them, helped them adjust to living in our culture and context? I mean, it would be great if we could lead them to Christ, but even if we didn't succeed at that, and instead we left a lasting positive impression on them of Christians, they might actually return home as leaders one day and eventually help to change the laws that have kept Christians out of their country. I believe we've neglected the call to take the gospel to the entire world for so long that God's been sending the entire world to us. They are our neighbors. There are people groups from all around the world who call the Metroplex their home. They live in the apartment community that surrounds our church, who come and play on the church's playground because there's no playground for kids in their apartment complex, and we love it. We even have a large group of group homes of disabled people who come to Spring Creek every month to enjoy a meal together, to sing, to engage in various activities and hear a Bible story. We call it the Jonathan Project. Do you know that there are a number of caregivers in those homes from non-Christian countries who accompany the residents each and every month, and they join in with the songs, the fun, and the Bible lessons too? The Jonathan Project is an excellent example of a ministry at Spring Creek that's already doing this, welcoming the stranger, creating a space for them among us, and making them feel welcomed and loved. What I'm saying is we don't have to invent stuff to do. We don't have to go out and find people like this because we're already connected with them because God has sent them here. They live among us, sometimes right next door to us. They're coming to us. I mean, God has literally brought people to our building inside and outside who just need someone to extend to them a heart of hospitality. You know, just a couple of weeks ago, Pastor Tammy had a conversation with a Muslim family who were playing on the playground that led to the mother asking about how to enroll her kids in Lionheart and whether we had ESL classes that could help her learn to speak English. How I wish we had a dedicated Christ follower who appreciated what an opportunity it would be to help people from outside our culture and context learn not just how to speak our language, but to know and understand that they were welcome and loved by someone who knows Jesus. But it takes a heart of hospitality, someone who creates the space for the outsider. The final thing, and I'll leave you with this, is this: their story, your story, his story. Stories are personal, meaningful, well-remembered, and you can't really argue with them. For postmoderns who value experience and use it as a guide, story's a big deal. Any opportunity to share Christ always begins by first listening to someone else's story. So let's talk about their story. Sharing Christ with others doesn't begin with Jesus, and it doesn't begin with you. It begins with the other person. Bottom line, people are not likely to accept a solution to a problem they don't think they have, or listen to answers to questions they've never asked. What I'm saying is there's a difference between someone who wants to win your soul versus someone who truly loves your soul. I don't think you can really listen to someone else's story unless you genuinely care about other people and want to learn from them. Besides, it's only in listening to their story that we find out where they're hurting, what they believe, what's working, and what's not. Their story is the place we find common ground. Did you know in the